Coming up right now is The Space Show.
This is your community radio station, 88.3 Southern FM.
Welcome to The Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie, and on the panel in Mission Control, we have Richard. On this evening's The Space Show, we are going to be turning back time, and we're going to be looking at the Apollo-Soyuz test mission. So, let's hear from Cher.
If I could turn back time, if I could find a way, baby. Turn back time.
50 years ago last week, there were two manned spacecraft, one from the Soviet Union and the other from the United States, orbiting the Earth. What was historic about this was that they were about to dock, and the five people aboard were going to mingle, visiting each other's spacecraft. The background to the Apollo-Soyuz test project is too complex to tell here, where essentially the Americans had been to the moon and the Soviets had to given up hope of doing so. NASA had one Apollo spacecraft left over after the moonshots and Skylab, so they could either fly it or put it in a museum. The Soviets now had an operational craft in the form of Soyuz. By linking up with the Americans, they thought that they would be seen as equals. Americans, particularly astronauts like Walter Cunningham, saw things differently. Cunningham recognized that the Apollo-Soyuz was a propaganda victory for the Russians.
The early Soviet space firsts may have been dubious technical achievements when compared to those of our own program, but they were certainly propaganda and public relations victories. The Apollo-Soyuz test project of 1975 fit that model perfectly, and the Soviets were well prepared to exploit it. It is useful to review ASTP in some detail because, in many ways, it set the pattern for all future cooperation between the two countries. Some of the precedents established with ASTP became problems in working together in both the Russian Mir space station and the International Space Station. My conclusions about ASTP were less influenced by politics than by my experience as an astronaut. The Russian space establishment had never been candid and forthcoming about their program, especially the failures. That behavior has carried through to the present day. I was less concerned with the 10-year-old American technology we gave away during the Apollo-Soyuz than I was with the risks it might portend in any continuing relationship. To the Soviets, it seemed an opportune time to hedge their bet. They had always viewed achievement in space as a measure of scientific, military, and even cultural strength. By that yardstick, the United States was riding high. Now we were offering them a chance to regain lost prestige with a minimum of risk. The Apollo-Soyuz mission in mid-1975 seemed like the answer to a prayer, if they only prayed.
One of the American astronauts assigned to the mission was Dick Slayton. Again, Walter Cunningham's view on that.
NASA selected a crew of real old-timers. Average age at the time, 46 years. Although only one had ever flown in space. Slayton, at 51, had been director of flight crew operations for 10 years. One of a handful of deputies reporting directly to Dr. Robert Gilruth, the director of the Johnson Space Center. Deke's career had suffered a bitter setback in 1962 when he failed a physical 2 months before he was to lift off as the second of the Mercury astronauts to go into Earth orbit. A squiggle in his electrocardiogram was enough to ground him for 10 years. Deke never let up in his efforts to return to flight status, even as it turned into a question of time. Could he beat the clock? Could he get ungrounded while there was still a flight left, or before he started collecting Social Security? At times, it seemed a little sad, like watching an old actor hanging around central casting, hoping for a call. We admired him for it, but in a corner of our hearts, we hurt for him too.
Cunningham thought the Soviets were smart in who they chose to crew Soyuz 19.
The Soviets threw in a first-class team for their half of this international space spectacular. Both were veterans of earlier space missions. Valery Kubasov, the 40-year-old flight engineer, had been a cosmonaut since 1966. He was shy, but a brilliant engineer. He seldom spoke during the joint training sessions. In the shadow of his more flamboyant fellow crewman and mission commander, Alexei Leonov, it was often hard to detect when Kubasov was around. Alexei Leonov was a bona fide Soviet hero. He was one of the original Soviet cosmonauts selected in 1960, and he made an indelible impression on the world in 1965 when he became the first man to walk in space.
The purposes of Apollo-Soyuz were many and varied, according to NASA. But Cunningham saw through the agency's spin.
Amidst all that international fellowship and the growing excitement of a space spectacular that both joined and pitted national pride, it became more and more difficult to pin down exactly what the objectives of the mission were. But along the way, these points were emphasized. The ASTP mission was described as essential for testing the technical solutions for compatible docking systems between the United States and Soviet spacecraft. That should have been a high priority for the USSR. Historically, docking has given the Russians more trouble than any other phase of their operations, with the possible exception of reentry. Many of their missions had been judged failures by U.S. experts because of unsuccessful dockings, while we had a near-perfect record in that essential phase of space operations. They had experienced docking hardware problems. But on this mission, both sides were utilizing the same design, one that evolved from a concept proposed by Rockwell for the Apollo command module in the early 60s. The system was put on the shelf at that time because it was much heavier than the probe and drogue concept we eventually employed. Now we handed it over to the Soviets, carte blanche. From its conception, the Apollo-Soyuz mission was touted as a demonstration of space rescue capability. Who could argue with that? In the last 60 days before the launch, knowledgeable Americans were facing up to the fact that we were buying an enormously expensive public relations stunt. In an effort to nudge along détente, the United States government encouraged the three major television networks to pool their resources to bring the country a record total of more than 30 hours of live coverage. It was, in short, much more international politics and public relations than a scientific mission.
Cunningham did see some positives from the Apollo-Soyuz test project.
But ASTP did have one redeeming feature, our first inside look at the Soviet space program. It took a while, but our scientists, technicians, and astronauts gradually and cautiously gained some trust. We had seen shadows on the wall and imagined monsters. And knowing the swift start they had made and the huge lead they once had, we were shocked when we finally saw their equipment. We had overrated the Russian hardware, their operations, and really their whole program. Our reluctant conclusions were incompatible with the giant that NASA, the Western world, and most Americans pictured as the Russian program of the 60s.
In retrospect, Cunningham thinks that the United States lost the propaganda war, by the personalities of the crew it selected.
Leonov's personality and his success at charming his American hosts pointed up one more area in which the Russians may have outfoxed us. In Stafford, Slayton, and Brand, we had selected technicians to do a technical job. All were attractive men and skilled professionals, but no one would describe them as first team on the Tea and Crumpets League. Their Russian counterparts had either been sent to a finishing school or selected on the basis of their charm, proficiency with the English language, and political astuteness. They did a splendid job. For us to match them in congeniality and social footwork, we would have had to send our first team in that category: Wally Schirra, Jim Lovell, and Gene Cernan.
So there we have it. 50 years ago, the first international docking in space on July 17 of 1975. Now, I don't usually interject my personal memories into the space show, but please allow me one about Apollo Soyuz. In New Zealand at the time, there was a tradition of late-night shopping, one night a week. Instead of closing at 5 p.m., retail shops closed at 9 p.m. It just so happened that the docking and international handshake occurred on the day of late-night shopping. Unlike in the United States, where events were shown live on network television, all that New Zealanders were going to see were brief clips on the regular evening news broadcasts. In 1975, there were two television channels, TV1 and TV2. TV2 had begun broadcasting just 2 weeks before Apollo Soyuz, so was quite a novelty. I had been dragged out to the shops, don't ask me why, and when the news came on, I was in a department store, George Courts, in fact, on Coronga Happy Road. In the electrical department, there were two television sets set up next to each other, one tuned to TV1 and the other to TV2. As the newcomer, the store staff had put on TV2 sound on, that put the sound on, and had silenced the TV1 receiver. In front of the TV2 receiver sat a crowd of children, avidly watching a program called Lost in Space. The only person watching the TV1 news report of the Apollo Soyuz was, you guessed it, little old me. I say watching because I dared not go to the TV set and turn the sound up. Well, let's turn now towards the present time. And Terry Virts is a former NASA astronaut who has worked with the Russians on the International Space Station. He discussed this cooperation in the context of Ukraine and the rise of Vladimir Putin with the Kiev Independent. Here's how the conversation went.
And on my crew, we had three Russian cosmonauts, and I launched from Russia and spent years living in Russia. But besides engineering and science, the international relation achievement was probably the best part of the space station, although we'll probably talk about that more. It's also, it's bittersweet. Yeah, so I was, this is 2014. I was very, like, rah-rah, like, you know, let's cooperate. This is, the space station's how people can and should get along with each other. There's all these bad things happening on Earth. I showed up for my training for this flight in 2012. It was on Victory Day, День Победы, and for Russian language training. And I remember walking around Moscow, and this was 2012. I was still very like pro-Russian, and I remember thinking, "This is really weird that they're turning this holiday into like a cult. It feels like a cult." Like Americans are proud. It's Memorial Day weekend this weekend. We're very proud that we helped win World War II. You know, both my grandfathers went over there and served. I'm proud of that. But like, we've moved on. There's other things in America that, and if you ask an American on the street, 99% of them could not tell you that May 8th was the day that the Nazis surrendered. Like, nobody knows that. Like, we've moved on with life. In Russia, it's literally the only thing that they talk about. And it's because of Putin's propaganda. And it's really perverted. They always have 1941 to 1945 signs in Russian cities. Well, the reality is they started the war in 1939. In 1939, they were on the side of the Nazis, and they invaded Eastern Europe, and they invaded Poland in September of 1939. And so the Putin propaganda machine has conveniently forgotten their role in this evil. They had an organization called Memorial that you're probably very familiar with that cataloged Stalin's crimes. I was in Magadan a few years ago, before the war, and that was where all the gulags were, right? That's where they took tens of thousands of Lithuanians and Estonians and Ukrainians and Russians, and they, you know, just did the most evil things of the 20th century. So they have conveniently forgotten that, and that's really, really dangerous, because that allows them to just propagandize and indoctrinate their population, which is not healthy. So I was there for Victory Day, which has been really perverted by Putin in a really terrible way. And I was also at, I didn't realize the significance at the time. I was walking one day near Pushkin Square in Moscow, and there was a rally, and it was Alexei Navalny. Because in 2012, that's when Putin was coming back. You know, he had left in 2008, and it was his chance to destroy the Russian Constitution and come back. And there were hundreds of thousands of protesters on the street back then. And I was like, oh, maybe I shouldn't be at this rally. So I just kind of left. But I was very familiar with that. And a really good friend of mine, a classmate from business school, who actually came to my launch, I said, hey, you guys are electing, Putin's coming back. So when are there debates? Can we watch debates? And he was like, we don't need debates. You know, just the complete acceptance that, yeah, that's a dictatorship. We're happy to live as slaves. That's kind of the Russian mentality. They're just resigned to the czar is going to make decisions, and they're not going to have any input into that. I love the cosmonauts. The favorite part of my time in space, I would take my dinner at night, and it was late. We were like working. They didn't have that much to do. They were down there watching TV and calling home on the IP phone. I'd have dinner with them every night, and we'd have Kulturny program where they would teach me, you know, words that you don't learn in Russian class. And we had a good time together. And my Anton Shkaplerov, my Soyuz commander, before we launched, they invaded Crimea. All this stuff was happening. And I remember thinking, you know, Obama's not doing anything about it. This is the weakest response I could imagine. What we should be doing is building out our LNG natural gas infrastructure. And let's hurt Putin in the pocketbook. We'll sell Europe natural gas and undercut Russia. We should have been doing that in 2014. Here, a decade later, we're still barely getting that process going. Anyway, he used to go around, you know, we would have parties on Friday night. He was like, Krim nash, Krim nash. Crimea's ours. And he was from Crimea. He was a Geroi Sevastopolia. He's from Sevastopol. He's a hero of Sevastopol. So, and his wife is Ukrainian. So it was just this perverted imperialism that, and I didn't know, I was still naive. This was 2014, but I remember going, this is really weird that my cosmonaut is so happy about just annexing. It's not 1939. In January of 2015, maybe February, I think it was January. We were flying over Europe one night. I was on the Russian segment with my colleague Sasha Samokutyaev, a different cosmonaut, and he got me a CSKA, this Russian state sports team. He was a hockey guy, so I have like a Russian state hockey jersey with my name on the back. And they always spell my name wrong. They spell it Vjorts instead of Verts. We were looking out the window, and we were flying over Europe, and it was like, oh, there's Ukraine. And all of a sudden, we saw these little red flashes on the ground. So we were watching Russians bomb Ukrainians in the winter of 2015. And after, it was just like profound. And I thought, I was affected by it, but the way he was affected by it, him and our colleague Yelena Sarova, another female cosmonaut, and another guy named Max Soraya that I flew with on my first flight. All three of them went to join Putin's party, and, you know, in the Duma, they were supporting the war. There's several other cosmonauts that I didn't fly with in the Duma. And these guys are the most enlightened people in the world. They should be. They lived in America. They know America's not going to go take over Russia. Just all this. They know all the propaganda is BS, and yet they still went to support this evil war. It was incredibly disappointing. Of all the bad things on Earth, the space station cooperation is actually has gone well, but, you know, they're using their space program to threaten nuclear annihilation. I had an incident one time on the Russian segment. We had this laptop software of places on Earth we were supposed to take pictures of, like the pyramids or this hurricane or whatever, and they had left their laptop open, and it was Aviano Air Base, a U.S. Air Force base in Italy that we had used extensively during the Serbian Kosovo conflict. And I was like, come on, guys. This is the I didn't do that. The U.S. does not do that. We have military, like, science payloads, but the Russians help us with it. It's a known thing. It's not used for, you know, actual intelligence gathering, but they do. And that was like, that didn't make me feel happy about what they're doing up there. We still need to live in the same house for the sake of the kids, but we're going to sleep in separate bedrooms. So we should not be launching NASA astronauts on the Russian Soyuz. That's just wrong. We shouldn't be having people in Moscow. They're at risk of getting arrested. We shouldn't be launching Russian Air Force officers on our capsules either. You can still operate the space station. It's only going to be up there for a few more years. We could operate it safely without launching on each other's capsules. But this administration has no interest in pushing back against Russia, and neither did the Biden. So that's not going to happen. I just personally believe that that's what should happen.
Former astronaut Terry Virts speaking earlier this year with a reporter from the Kiev Independent. This is The Space Show.
You're listening to 88.3 Southern FM, the sounds of the Bayside.
On this evening's Space Show, we are looking back 50 years to the Apollo-Soyuz mission and forward to today and what's happening now. And the cooperation between the Soviet Union, as it then was, and now Russia, and the United States and other countries. Now, listening to Terry Virts there, brought to mind the movie 2010, The Year We Make Contact. The Soviet Union and the United States have joined forces for a joint mission to Jupiter to investigate what happened to the Discovery, which is still orbiting Jupiter after Bowman disappeared into the monolith in 2001, A Space Odyssey. The joint expedition sets off in the Russian spaceship called the Leonov, after Alexei, of course. They arrive and dock with the American Discovery. All is going, Discovery, of course, by this time is now completely unmanned. All is going well until news arrives from Earth.
As you know, things have not been going well back home. Well, it's gotten worse, a lot worse. Yesterday, a Soviet destroyer challenged the blockade. Several warning shots were fired across her bow. She did not respond. A second volley was fired. There still was no response. None. The nuclear destroyer USS Cunningham launched two of her Falcon missiles. Both struck the Soviet vessel amidship. She broke in two and sunk. 800 of her crew were lost. This morning, an American surveillance satellite was struck by a Soviet laser fired from the Sergei Kirov space station. The American satellite was destroyed. The United States has broken off diplomatic relations with Russia. All ambassadors have been recalled. The Soviet ambassador has been expelled along with the entire staff. All American air defense and satellite defense forces are on full alert. Premier Ulanova made a televised address and said that technically a state of war exists between our two countries. All American personnel are ordered to leave Soviet territory immediately or they will be placed under arrest. All Russian personnel are similarly ordered to evacuate American territory. As a result, by direct presidential order, the three of you must leave the Leonov. No Russian citizen is allowed to remain on or is allowed to enter the Discovery. This order is effective immediately. The launch window for reentry is 28 days. The Discovery has enough fuel for low consumption trajectory. HAL appears to be reactivated and is functioning well enough to operate the onboard systems. The Leonov has enough fuel for a low consumption trajectory that will arrive 12 months earlier. The launch windows are critical for both the spacecraft. Only communications of an emergency distress nature are allowed between the Leonov and Discovery. I know you people are caught in the middle of this, in a sense, we all are. I wish there was something I could do. The only thing left for us is to pray. Pray for the safety of our families, for our countries, for our planet. May God forgive us and protect us.
To find out what the Russian and American astronauts do, you may care to watch the full movie. 2010, The Year We Make Contact, is available on DVD and Blu-ray. Now, I've been able to find only one song about Apollo Soyuz. This is Space Congress by America's Chuck Morley, who wrote it in 2017. Let's take a listen.
Tell all Earth's nations to be of good cheer. A new day of hope is now dawning. An era of brotherhood both far and near. As space heralds peace loud and clear, Apollo has stirred all our heartstrings. Skylab proved what can be done. Space shuttle renews our beginnings, and we've just met Soyuz in the sun. There'll come a time when all nations join hands in space to bring peace o'er the land.
Short and sharp, that Space Congress, ASTP by Chuck Morley.